here at a critical moment.
Hello, I'm Dan Brown.
And I'm Brandi Crawford Uryu. We are your TV BFFs, and this is a podcast about the TV shows that people love most. Each episode, we bring on a guest to discuss their top six shows of all time based on what we call the BFF criteria. With so much TV out there, we want to know, what are the best shows you've ever seen? What are your absolute favorite shows? And what shows would you watch on a loop forever?
That's right. In each episode, our guests will pick two shows in each of the three BFF categories, those being their best, favorite, and forever shows, while choosing from the three genres of TV, which are drama, comedy, and unscripted. So let's get right to our incredible guest for this episode. He is one half of the Los Culturistas podcast. He's a writer and an actor who you have seen and heard in shows like I Love That For You and Q-Force. He's a comedian and a performer, and his debut comedy special, Have You Heard of Christmas, is out now and streaming on Showtime. Please welcome Matt Rogers.
Hi, it's so fun to be here. Have you guys ever sort of discussed the fact that you sort of have a TV couple name? It's very easy. It's Dandy. It would be very easy for people to ship you. Have you talked about it?
We haven't.
That's the first we're hearing of it. I love
it. Oh my God.
We're going to steal that. Thank you for that.
Yeah, we need to use that for promotional purposes.
I give it to you. It's public domain.
Oh, that's so much fun. So Matt, thank you again for coming on. We always talk about, like, when we were first talking about this criteria, like who were some of our dream guests, and you were always at the very top of that list. So this is so much fun for us. We're both big Los Culch fans, readers, publicists, the whole nine. So
that's so nice, honestly, to know we have like cool, smart readers out there is the best thing ever. I mean, honestly, that's really, really kind. And I love the show and like think it's such a fun way to talk about things because you really can compartmentalize these things in different ways. There's like the rewatchable, there's the things that you will never forget but will never watch again. And there are those things that you more relate to and like maybe now they don't hit as hard, but at a time they really did. You know what I mean? There's the way you've packaged it is really, it's very clear and very evocative.
Well, we're both TV development executives, so we kind of do this. The formatting thing is kind of...
So you know what you're talking about.
We've done it a few times, but this was always really fun. And I will say, you know, as a listener of your podcast, there is a bit of what culture made you say culture is for you layered in here a little bit, specifically more like
totally.
Favorites and forevers. When I was thinking about my list, that's kind of a way to maybe think about it when we talk about our favorite and forever shows. It's like those core...
Absolutely. What's funny is like several of the ones I gave you, actually, I could probably use to answer the question, what was the culture that made you say culture was for me, to be honest, which if people don't know, that's the sort of touchstone of our podcast is we ask all of our guests, what was the pop culture or culture that made you say culture was for you? Like basically saying, what made you start to become yourself in terms of the culture that you were experiencing, letting right. influence you. And I looked at my list again and I was like, wow, yeah, I could really sort of trace back my personality to a lot of these fundamental shows and series.
Yeah. Brandi, because I feel like for me, like one show we talk about a ton is The Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me would probably be my answer. Like that was the first show that felt like my own. My parents didn't watch it, although my mom got me into the real world and things like that. And then it kind of like fostered this, like, I love developing competition shows and game shows and competition reality. And that's, I think, really where it started. That and a very specific episode of Friends, which I've talked about as well, the game show episode. But like those two things.
Yeah, I would say that I knew culture was for me at a young age, and it was all due to TGIF.
Oh, TGIF was huge.
I love TGIF. I like those were the families I've like
major.
I was like, I like that's how I based like any story or anything that I would write like as a kid or like, you know, middle school, high school and stuff was all in some way based on a storyline I'd seen on TGIF.
No, because you know what? Well, you know what I loved about TGIF was at any given time, like the four shows that were blocking out that Friday night programming, they all definitely were solid, straightforward sitcoms, but they were all very different worlds. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like I believe at one time you had like Boy Meets World on with like Hanging with Mr. Cooper with like the Clueless sitcom.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like it was like these very step-by-step. step by step. I literally was like, you know, it was very different. It was like there was like a Friends type sitcom that was more about social life, which I would, of course, Boy Meets World is like a family show, but it wasn't like a really a family sitcom the way that like Step by Step was. And then Clueless was more of like an extension of the social commentary of the movie, and The Hangout with Mr. Cooper was, you know, its own vibe. And so like it was just really, that's really interesting that you bring that up, because I don't think there is like people our age that were experiencing television that aren't influenced by that. I remember getting on the bus in the morning on Fridays, and my mom, I would look out the window and she would go, she'd make the sign with her hand.
Oh,
she'd go,
TGIF.
Yeah. Like she would get me excited. I think it was like 5 or 6, like get me excited to come home and like have dinner and then watch TGIF or however late I could make it. Probably 9:30-ish.
Yeah.
And well, it's so crazy because like I have kids now, and like it would never occur to me to be watching TV with them. Like they are in the bed at 8 o'clock, but I guess maybe like as they get to be older, they'll be staying up and stuff. I hadn't even thought about like, oh my God, I'm going to get to watch TV with my own kids.
Yeah.
That's not fucking Paw Patrol.
Right. Exactly. It's not giving Peppa Pig. You know what I mean? It's something that we actually want to experience.
If I could never watch Peppa Pig again, like it would be too soon.
Nowadays, it's like, you know, they're not even really saying human words. It's like whatever the names are, the Oodles or whatever. I don't even know. But I went over to my friend's house to meet their kid, and I was like, this is what they watch. And then he was like, yeah, but you know what's funny? We snuck on the other day, Q-Force. And the little girl was so young, she could never understand. But literally, it was like, they had Q-Force on, and because it was a cartoon, she was like glued to it. But obviously, the content was not actually hitting with her underdeveloped brain.
Yeah. Sure.
But it was visual and fun.
How old is this child?
She, at the time, was like 18 months. Oh, which, sure, you know what I mean? Like, probably just like watching what's happening on it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not engaging. Probably for the best. We had some pretty raw anal sex jokes in there, to be explicit.
All right. We should talk about some of your shows, I think. So
let's talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. So before we get into your BFFs, and like what made your actual criteria, we want to know a little more about your overall TV watching history. So let's start with you letting us know what shows were in the mix for your best, favorite, and forever shows, but they didn't quite make the cut. So what were some of your almost shows or your honorable mentions?
Yeah, so as you guys know, it's because it's your damn show. It's best, favorite, and forever. And so what I always go back to is like, you know, when I started studying TV writing, I really felt like I had to watch everything because we were very much encouraged to do that. And I went to school for writing at Tisch School of the Arts. I was in the dramatic writing program from 2008 to 2012. So this was actually a huge time for golden era, what they were calling the golden age of television at the time. So this was like, you know, and network TV was flourishing. I mean, ABC in particular had like very much the trio for me, which was Lost, Desperate Housewives, and Grey's Anatomy. But then AMC was becoming a major prestige stop with Breaking Bad, which almost made my list today for best shows. But the reason I couldn't in good faith say it's going to actually make a list for me that I'll talk about at length was because I remember binging Breaking Bad on projectfreetv.com because there was no way to just stream it. So yes, I was stealing it because it was the only way.
AMC makes it way too hard. They've always been like that. They make it so difficult.
It's very difficult to watch it. But again, I was told I absolutely must by my teachers. And so I watched Breaking Bad, and I actually made it through the first 3 seasons of Breaking Bad thinking it was incredible. Absolutely enthralled. The performances, the writing, the direction, amazing. It was just like nothing I had ever seen before. Truly like a movie every week. And then I remember the season 4 premiere happened, and it's the scene where Gus slits the guy's throat in front of Walt and Jesse to kind of prove a point about don't fuck with me.
Box cutter.
With the box cutter. I realized during the scene, I sort of zoomed out again, and I was like, oh, I'm having a panic attack. I was like, I can't actually watch this anymore because it's too stressful for me. Something that's like really important to know about me and my TV watching habits is I really don't like to be stressed out. So I can't even try with like anything horror, like too much suspense, like really intense thriller. I can't actually get there because it actually puts me in a place of physical discomfort. That being said, I can acknowledge that this was one of the best television shows of all time. I mean,
and like, you didn't finish it. Did you ever go back?
Watched the series finale.
Just the finale. Okay.
Yes, because I was like, let me be a part of like this cultural conversation here.
Sure.
But it actually was too effective. And it was working on me too well, to the point where I was like, I am living alongside this in a way that I do not enjoy. So because I didn't like watching it anymore, I had to stop. But I have to acknowledge it as being one of the best drama series of all time.
Wow.
With some of the best performances.
Truly.
And I mean, one of the most stressful shows ever. It's like, ever. If you get stressed out, like, you should not be watching Breaking Bad.
Oh, no, no. If there's a beta blocker in your closet, the show is not for you.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Okay, so Breaking Bad, that's interesting. I don't think we've had an almost show that was left unwatched, that was left unfinished. So I really like that, but I appreciate where you're coming from. What else was close? What else was just on the outside looking in?
So for my favorite show, I almost said Desperate Housewives, because I think that this is when my queerness was starting to like really rage in me in high school, and I just like loved watching these women. And it was harder for me to sort of like sneak Sex in the City in the house because it was so explicit and on HBO, and I would have to wait for my parents to leave for hours so that I could go on HBO on demand and watch Sex in the City. But Desperate Housewives, my mother said to me, this is my new favorite show. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, it's on ABC on Sunday nights. Like, I'm going to stick around and watch it with her. And I just loved, like, you know, I loved the satirical element, which it sort of lost as it went. And then it became more of a soap, which was also fine. But the reason why I hesitate to put it as one of my favorites is because I kind of feel like I'm saying earlier, like, it kind of became like everything else as it went. Whereas in its first season, I thought it was very rich in satirical tone. And I thought it was actually even bordering on surreal at times, but in a way that, like, I feel like that show could have gone sci-fi and I would have bought it. There were some moments of season one where I was like, what the fuck is going on this street?
Right. Is it witchcraft? Who knows?
Yeah, I love the humor. I love a juicy, big actress performance. There was four of them, sometimes five. On later seasons, sometimes six or seven. Like, you know, and then I think sometimes, like, just because it lost the satirical bite and sort of went more soap, I hesitate to say across the board it's the most consistent thing that I could put in my favorite shows. That being said, I love a soap. You know what I mean? Like, but because it started as one thing and ended as another, I just preferred what it was. But I remember when Desperate Housewives came on, like, I hadn't seen anything like it. And I really liked it. And that's sort of, if I could go back in time, I could tell myself, like, this is why you're going to love Housewives, you know? Because ultimately, The Real Housewives was essentially a spinoff of that. In many ways, I believe it was pitched as like a The OC and Real Housewives, or a Desperate Housewives hybrid that was going to be unscripted. So it all makes sense when I trace it back. But true. Desperate Housewives was major for me.
Matt, one show that you didn't send to us, you didn't mention, but I wanted to bring up, especially now that you mentioned Desperate Housewives. I've not seen The Morning Show anywhere in contention. My question is, what do the third graders need to do to get The Morning Show where it could be in contention for a favorite sort of vibe?
They need to keep following their instincts because they're doing a great job so far. So my bit, for people that don't know, is that third graders write The Morning Show. I believe that The Morning Show is written in a way that suggests a third grade teacher says to a class at the beginning of the day, hey guys, okay, so today what you're going to do is you're going to write an episode of TV. And it can be anything you want, but it has to take place at a daytime TV show. Okay, bye. Leaves the room, comes back at 3 o'clock, and whatever they have presented to her, that's what goes on Apple TV Plus. And I swear to God, you will love your life. You will love the way you look, I guarantee it, if you watch The Morning Show as if that's the case. You'll laugh your ass off. I'm telling you, The Morning Show is, it's just a whole hunk of pulp, and I love it. And honestly, like,
truly, truly.
You're right. It does sort of belong on this list. But I can't after it's only two seasons. Yeah. Like, let's wait for them to land this third one, you know, and see what they do with John Hamm, who they can somehow also afford on this cast.
It's wild.
I am so as shook by what the budgets are on this show. It is so crazy, but I am going to remain watching till the end of time. And then my last one that almost made my forever was Sex and the City, which I just mentioned.
Oft chosen. That's been in the mix.
Yeah, it's a great forever.
I mean, it almost like goes without saying. You know what I mean? Like we're of this generation. Like, it was the show I couldn't really watch, but always wanted to watch. It was zeitgeisty, but outside my realm, so that when I could, I loved it. You know, I spent my 20s in New York. Like, they were always aspirational. They were extremely well-dressed. I loved, you know, the conversations that they would have. It would make me feel like it actually was the closest thing that I could recognize when I actually did look back on when I was in my 20s, actually having brunch with my friends. Like, it actually did an incredible job of the frankness with which we discussed these types of things. So really ahead of its time, and also just so fun to watch, and also talk about great performances. I mean, so great. Like, so great. And Sarah Jessica Parker as Carrie Bradshaw is, like, for me, top three TV characters of all time, I think.
Wow.
That's a good one.
Okay, so we're learning things with these Olmos shows. So let's get to your BFF criteria. We asked you, as a quick reminder, we asked you to pick two shows in each criteria, those being your best, favorite, and forever shows. So your best shows are the ones that you think are just the most artistic, most well-executed, just overall, these are the best-made shows you've ever seen. They should win all the awards every time. Your favorite shows are the ones that hold a place near and dear to your heart. They mean something to you more personally, maybe more nostalgic. And then for the forever category, if in the afterlife you get to choose two shows to watch in order, from pilot to finale, no skips, for infinity, what are those two shows?
So for each category, we had you choose from the three overall genres of TV, which we are defining as comedy, drama, and all things unscripted. And so unscripted is everything from reality shows to documentary series to game shows. And there must be multiple episodes. So no one-offs allowed. But other than that, it can be anything. And guess what? There's no such thing as guilty pleasures here. We want to talk about it all. So the only other rule, because we have to have a couple rules, is that you can only double up on a genre in one of your three BFF categories. So for instance, if you were to pick two dramas in your best category, you can't double up in your faves or your forevers. So make sense?
Yes, I don't think I doubled up at all. I think I played the game pretty well.
Yeah.
But I will say, I do sound like an extremely basic millennial with my choices. Like, it's really giving what it's giving.
I mean, it's giving peak TV for sure. But like, listen, like, peak TV is peak TV for a reason. You know what I mean? Although there is one, there's one that I have great many questions about, but we shall get there when we get there. But first, what is your first best show pick, Matt Rogers?
So my first best show pick is Mad Men.
Let's go.
For me, Mad Men, it hits on every single cylinder, and I also think perfectly executed its landing. I would wager to say that this is, in terms of like just how you construct a pilot and how you see that vision and tone through all the way to the end, I don't think that you get better than this show. I really don't. It's also a larger ensemble than you think. And every single character is a fully living, breathing, interesting human being from number one to number 200 on this call sheet. I mean, there are often times when a character comes in for one episode or even one scene or one sequence, and you leave remembering them forever. Just to say one off the top of my head, Neve Campbell. Neve Campbell on Mad Men is in a great episode where she rides in the plane next to Don Draper.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, they're like taking naps on each other. And like, they have this like extremely lived in, complicated dynamic already. And she never returns. But it says so much about the type of man that Don Draper is and how he uses relationships and what he's used to getting, receiving, and learning from particularly women in his life. And so that's just one, though. And the fact that they got someone like Neve Campbell to come in and do just a sort of one-off role like that, I think is a testament to the power that the show had.
Yeah,
I remember letting this show seep over me and knowing that maybe not everything was going to happen in like a firecracker, like, pulpy way. And remember, I was used to, like, you know, Desperate Housewives.
Sure.
But this was the first show I ever let really wash over me in terms of tone, to the point where, like, in this third, fourth season, a character would look at someone a certain way and I'd be screaming running around my room. You know what I mean? Like, truly, I think just top to bottom perfect.
Became very immersive, right? It felt you trip and fall over into the world, almost as if you're, you know, falling into it in that iconic credit sequence. You know what I mean? Where the character's kind of falling, you know, into this world and lands on that couch. Like, I always thought that was a very smart show open. It was one I never skipped, and it kind of, it made me feel like that person in some way, to kind of just like falling into this world, falling into the 60s, falling into the world of Mad Men every time the show came on, you know?
Yes. I also think it was perfectly of its time, weirdly enough, because while it was a period piece about, you know, the 60s, eventually sort of the 70s.
In the 70s, yeah.
This era, I also think it was making a comment about misogyny and about sexism and about the workplace reality at a time before it felt like everything was saying that. And what's interesting about it now, looking back, is while I do say I do think it's one of the best television shows of all time, you also can fully acknowledge that there were problematic work dynamics in that work environment. I mean, there have been things that have come out about Matthew Weiner and Cater Gordon, who won an Emmy for writing together, where she, you know, says it was an extremely, like, there was harassment going on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so it's an insight into this that ultimately, like, when you zoom out, actually, like, maybe was even at play.
Yeah.
But as a piece of art itself, it really seemed to understand that in a way that, like, now seems a little nefarious, but at the time felt very textured and layered. And, you know, it's almost even more disappointing that that's the case when you look back at this, because this is someone who very clearly understands what it means to be powerless in a workplace scenario. He showed it time and time again.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not only just between men and women, but also between, you know, different power dynamics, the powerful versus the ones who are not, you know, someone trying to come up in the industry. So it's just a really fascinating piece of art in that it now, I don't know if it holds up under scrutiny in that regard, but it certainly it's worthy of discussion because, you know, it was of course about ad men in the 60s, but it was really about all the social themes of this time. I mean, gosh, what's her, Tiana Paris from WandaVision, had a great role in the show, and it was glimpses into what the Black experience was, but, in those glimpses, it seemed like well-researched and everything, but then there was, like, same thing with the homosexual experience with the character of Sal, you know what I mean? Like, very, like, hard truths and realities about not just these straight men that run the ad agency, but everyone in the ecosystem of this world, and it was just, that's what I mean when I say, like, every character was interesting, because they were specific and they left you thinking.
Yeah.
So it's that's what I loved about this show.
Like, one character, and when you said that, my brain went to this character, and he was also brought up before. And so I think it's a really great example of this sort of thing that you're describing about the show. We had James Coker on, and he put Mad Men in his criteria, and he mentioned the character Bob.
Bob, really stuck I was going to say.
And Bob, and I think about him all the time, not just because one of the most iconic, most memeable, you know, not great Bob moments, but that character, to your point, like, didn't feel like he was the most important in the company or on the show, like, you know, way down on the call sheet, even though I'm blanking on the actor who played him was wonderful.
He's so hot. I remember I had such a crush on him. Like, he was great. Like, but yes, but I was going to say Bob.
Bob, like, right?
Like, to the point where there were, like, fan theories about, like, whether he was, like, a psyop.
What?
There was people being like, he's there. He's from the FBI. He's spying on Don. Like, he knows. Like, there was all these things going on online, because I was also very online at the time.
Sure, okay.
And, yeah, people really made more of him than he ended up being.
James Wolk.
James Wolk.
James Wolk.
James Lone Star Wolk. Oh, let me make sure we never forget that. No, that is an attractive man.
Wait, so Matt, were you watching Mad Men live? Did you start a little later? Like, kind of, were you watching it from when it premiered? Like, because when did it come? Like, 2007?
Something 2007, I believe. And so I don't think I really discovered it until 2009-10. And then I started, I caught up again on projectfreetv.com. I was a little thief. And then I caught up to it and was obsessed and ultimately watched every episode live until its series finale.
Have you rewatched?
I have. In fact, it's actually season two is on it's on Delta. So I watched a lot of the whole season was on Delta, and I was like, oh my God, my flight couldn't have been long enough. But another thing too is when characters left, you missed them. And like, I remember Carla, the housekeeper. Remember the day that Betty fired her, I was so mad at Betty. I was like, I don't think I'll ever like her again. Because when she made her go and didn't let her say goodbye to the kids.
Yeah.
That was when Betty lost me forever, and that hurt. But like, so many characters, like Rachel Menken, you know what I mean? Yeah. And again, I'm naming a lot of the women because that's what I want to do, but truly, like, just an encyclopedia, like a Sopranos-esque encyclopedia of really interesting people that populated the world. I also loved Pete and Trudy Campbell. Yes. I thought they were just walking art.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
their choreographed dance at that like weird camp, and then John Slattery in the blackface. I was like, this was like that, it was so weird.
Yeah.
Like, and that's another thing is like the show understands two things. One, that people are fucking weird. And in that room, you could tell when the weird idea was pitched, they were like, that.
Yeah.
Like, how do we follow that? Instead of like, no, that doesn't make sense. They were like, that's weird. What else?
Yeah.
Yeah. Megan's doing Zooby Zooby Doo.
Zooby Zooby Zoo was, you couldn't make it up. And somehow they did. Zooby Zooby Zoo, that, and I loved Megan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Megan, the fact was that great. She came out of where she came out, like, I'll never forget when Sally Draper is running down the hall and she falls on the ground and Megan is the one who comforts her and she goes, I fall all the time. And she hugs her, the Sally Draper hugs her, and she goes, it's going to be okay. And Sally goes, no, it's not. And then that woman became her stepmother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they had like a complicated relationship, but we saw their first meeting. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that was really well placed. And like the fact that he wanted to be with her because she cleaned up the spill at the diner without getting upset. You know what I mean? Like, it's those little tiny things that only an audience that has been seeped in the culture and behaviors of characters in a show can understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That show was very good at small moments. That show was very good at very small moments.
No, absolutely. I mean, like, and we haven't even mentioned Joan. Like,
oh, we have not she mentioned was so... Joan. Or Peggy, quite honestly.
Oh, my God. I mean, the suitcase, the episode called The Suitcase, just... but you never say thank you. That's what the money is for.
And by the way, I know it kills you, but guess what? There is no Danny's idea. Everything that comes in here belongs to the agency.
You mean you?
As long as you still work here.
Is that a threat? Because I've already taken somebody up on one of those tonight.
Relax.
You know what? Here's a blank piece of paper. Why don't you turn that into glow coat?
Are you out of your mind? You gave me 20 ideas, and I picked out one of them that was a kernel that became that commercial.
So you remember?
I do. It was something about a cowboy. Congratulations.
No, it was something about a kid locked in a closet because his mother was making him wait for the floor to dry, which is basically the whole commercial.
It's a kernel.
Which you changed just enough so that it was yours.
I changed it into a commercial. What, are we going to shoot him in the dark in the closet? That's the way it works. There are no credits on commercials.
But you got the Clio.
It's your job. I give you money, you give me ideas.
And you never say thank you.
That's what the money is for.
Let's move on to your next best show. Matt, what do you have up next to Mad Men?
Survivor.
There it is. There she is.
Survivor is the blueprint. Survivor is, it changed television. It actually is the best hosting ever on television. What he's capable of as a host, how he sees everything but remains, you know, an observer. He is calling things out at all times. The social dynamics we've seen at play, I mean, it is the social chess game. It is the best game in the world. It is so difficult, so hard. You really see the human spirit tested.
Yeah.
To me, now it's got a little bit too heavy on twists and it's just a little too interested in gameplay and less on human interaction and social gameplay, which it used to be. I think the best years of the show were when it was in its teen years. I refer to it as the Parvati era. That was when it was at its best, and some seasons in the 20 era. And every now and then it will have a really good season. Like, I currently think it's having a very good season.
This season is very good, I think, yeah.
I do agree. I do agree, because I think there's really interesting people playing.
That's the thing.
And I think the show is best when they are highlighting the social dynamics and not the gameplay in terms of how are they going to make this twist work for them.
Right. When it works best in this new era, and then I want to get back to, you know, more facets of why it's in your best. But like when they're doing things like this season with like the bracelet, the beads advantage, where it's like, okay, it's a twist, it's an extra layer of gaminess, it's another idol, but you do need to lean into actual social skills. We're seeing things happen at camp that are going to have repercussions down the line based on how they play this conversation, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Like, those are smart wrinkles, I think, in this new era.
I would agree. That's like a triumph of them trying to make this shit work. Like, they landed on this. Like, whoever pitched that nailed it that day because of the social element. Yes.
Right. Exactly.
Because that is ultimately what makes the show such a gasp inducer, mm-hmm. is when someone pulls off something socially. And what I love about the show now, which I think is different from the beginning, is that people, when they get got, are like, fuck, that was good.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
like in the true. Old days, like, I don't know if you've ever rewatched like the first All-Stars season.
No, I haven't.
It is so ugly because they're taking it so personally.
Yeah.
And it's just like a failure to understand that it's a game that makes it really hard to watch. Now everyone knows it's a game. And so when there's backstabbing, it's like, fuck, good job.
Right.
You know,
well, because you can't find someone who hasn't watched the show religiously who's now on the show, right? Everyone is a fan.
No, the snake has eaten its own tail and they had to respond
to
that.
Big time. Yeah, big time. I still think they should go back to the full amount of days, though. I know it started as a COVID thing, but like, go back to the regular number of days.
I agree.
You know?
I agree.
Okay, so this is In Your Best, and you mentioned you watched all 40 plus seasons over the pandemic. Was that rewatching some, watching others for the first time? Like, what is your Survivor history? And then what did that rewatch do to launch it up, you know, your all-time rankings for specifically reality, which you've mentioned you watch a lot of?
Yeah. So I was a huge obsessed fan when I was younger. Like, I remember the first season, I remember the second season, like everyone in America. I mean, like, that was, well, first of all, it introduced us to Elizabeth Filarski, who would become Elizabeth Hasselbeck. And I remember she was fucking America's sweetheart.
Right.
How things have changed. But I remember, like, what I loved was, again, the iconic characters. And I probably watched all through season 8-ish. Like, that All-Star season, I think, just got too weird. And I was like, this isn't fun right now.
Right.
And then didn't watch again for years and years and years until the pandemic. And you know what's funny is I have some gays in my life that are obsessed with it. My friend Chris Schleicher, who's a TV writer, he works with Mindy Kaling a lot. Guy Branum is an absolute Survivor freak. My good friend Pat Regan, who writes on Hacks, like, he loves Survivor. And my friend Aaron Jackson, like, everyone loves Survivor, like, and a lot of gays. And I was like, maybe I have to try this again. And so the pandemic happened. I said, well, I have 2 weeks off. Like, why don't I get on what was at the time CBS All Access?
Right.
and watch. And so I found it to be an amazing way to get to the end of the day, because you could wake up, roll out of bed at 9, and around like 11:30, you kind of had seen a whole season. And what I loved was, like, it moved. It was like, okay, we're at the beach. Reward challenge. We're talking about it. Yeah. Immunity challenge. Tribal council.
We're back.
Yeah. We're done. We're about the beach. Reward challenge. And I was just like,
good
okay,
rhythms.
Yes,
good
I
rhythms.
Am getting, like, I am really eating bad on my couch during the pandemic watching this, but I became obsessed and brought that back to my Lost Cult listeners, the readers, and it became a whole thing. It was like an arc on our podcast, how obsessed Bowen and I became with Survivor. And we actually had Parvati Shallow on. We've had Zeke Smith on.
Yeah.
We've had Eliza Orlins on. Like, you know, we've had several Survivor contestants on to talk about it. And I like to think that we actually got some people to watch it. And I do think it's true that it's had sort of a resurgence because it was such a good pandemic watch.
Matt, I have to say, you absolutely got people to watch it. So much so, in fact, a previous guest on this podcast, Christian Bonda, he was listening to your podcasts and, like, we talked about it. He's like, I'm not sure if it was explicit or if just, like, it being in the air, like, motivated me, but he watched the whole thing over the pandemic and then was, you know,
that's
tweeting about
so
it
funny.
And, like, got interviewed in Esquire about it. And then at the very end of the episode, he's a podcast producer. So we did, like, a quick BFFs with his podcast and he mentioned Lost Cult in his little lightning round. And, like, then it all kind of came together. It's like, wait, that was the Survivor? Like, the loop came full circle for him, like, in that moment.
That makes me happy. Honestly, that's why I love doing the podcast, because I like to show people what I love. And then hopefully if they like it too, that obviously, like, causes conversation, you know?
Sure.
Like, Yeah, no, and I'll share with your listeners my Survivor watch order. So this is like the seasons that I think are the best. This is the order you should watch.
The best of the best. I love it. This is perfect.
Season 7, Pearl Islands. Season 13, Cook Islands. Season 15, China. Season 16, Micronesia. Season 18, Tokenshins. Season 20, Heroes versus Villains. Then talk to me.
Okay.
So those are my marching orders because I have never watched Survivor.
You're going to love the way you look.
I never got into Survivor because I was like, I don't really love competition shows that are outside. I prefer
specific. I love that.
I prefer a studio-based game show. but I always love the real world, always love the challenge. Yeah. But I have friends that are like, why aren't you watching Survivor? Like, you should be watching it.
I really do think it's the best reality show of all time.
All right. I like having a list.
Yes, that's your list.
It's a little overwhelming to look at how many seasons there are.
Because you want to know what? There's too many to where it'll get overwhelming. But once you watch these, however many I just suggested, you'll want to do more. And then what was so great about the pandemic was I had watched everything and they just so happened to be airing the season called Winners at War, which was 20 winners all coming back to compete. And essentially, like, what do they call the Hunger Games catching fire thing? Like the
quarter quell?
The quarter quell. Yeah. it was like a quarter quell of Survivor winners. And that was a really satisfying season.
Wow,
and also such a legacy watch that to have seen that after I had watched all of the seasons was like, I was emotional about it. It was
the cherry on top. That's incredible.
And all the people you wanted to come back came back, which was also great. And it was a miserable season for them. Like, it was it was so painful to watch. Like, and you could see in all their faces, they were like, now why the fuck would I do this to myself? But that just goes to show, like, I mean, the power of that show.
Oh, man. Well, a sensational 1 and 2 is your best picks. Mad Men and Survivor, Matt Rogers' best shows.
Yeah, argue with me. Come on.
All right, Matt, let's move on to your favorite shows. What's the first pick in your favorite category?
So I had to say Lost because I can trace the moment that I wanted to be in television and in entertainment back to. It was season 1, episode 6 of Lost. The episode was called House of the Rising Sun. And it was about the characters Sun and Jin. It was told from Sun's perspective, who was played by the great Korean actress Yoon-jin Kim, who turned a performance on Lost and never got like nominated for an Emmy or anything, but she was amazing. And Jin was played by Daniel Dae Kim, who's like gone on to huge success. This was like a breakout for both of them. And I remember their flashback episode showed that they were in a very unhappy marriage, you know, et cetera. And like they had crash landed on this island and they had showed a flashback to them being in the airport prior to getting on the doomed flight 815. There was a moment where she had arranged to get picked up by a car and driven away because she was going to leave him. And I remember the score was playing, the great score by Michael Giacchino, who went on to score some incredible films and television shows since. But this was really his big moment, was Lost.
Yeah.
And the score to Lost, the orchestra of Lost, was just so amazing, especially for TV at the time. Like, it really elevated that show and television at the time.
It really did.
It felt so grand and cinematic. And I'll never forget the scene because she takes a few steps towards this car, which is pulled up to pick her up, looks over her shoulder, and he just shows her favorite flower, which I believe was an orchid. And she comes back and he says, why are you crying? And she says, because I'm happy. And they flash back to the beach and they're miserable and not speaking. And, you know, she's keeping from him that she's learned English.
Right.
You know, as to try to get away. And I think that what connected with me so much was the raw emotion of the moment. It was the music, it was the acting, it was the situation that had been set up, it was the fact that we knew that it ended in despair. And I said to myself, I want to be a part of creating television. Like, I want to be a TV writer, because I don't think I had understood up until that point that, like, it was someone's job to do that. Like, I thought, I knew I was a good writer in school. I was good at English class and stuff, but it never connected with me that was something you could do.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, and I don't know why it took me this, but it took seeing, like, written by so-and-so in the credits to understand this was a job you could have.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, that would be the best job in the world. That would be a dream come true to be able to create this moment for someone else at home. Mm-hmm. And I also think that I was afraid to admit it at the time because, you know, this is a longer conversation about closetedness, but I just never wanted to say I wanted to be an actor or a performer because of, you know, whatever trauma that would inflict on me in an exterior way because of my surroundings or whatever. But I knew I wanted to be part of entertainment. And I thought that's what it is. Like, they're actually creating it, the writers. So that show, that first season of that show, I was discovering what I wanted to do. It was truly the culture that made me say culture was for me. That, and in many ways, American Idol. It was this unforgettable time of me realizing I had a favorite show. Mm. And it became my personality, too. Like, I would come in and I'd be like, I couldn't wait for them to dive into a new character's backstory. I couldn't figure out enough about these people, the mystery element. And also, we should say, there's a reason why this isn't in my best section, because this show obviously fell the fuck apart and it became incredibly hard to defend. But if you're looking back on my favorite show, just the way it was structured and the way it was told and the wildness of it and the big swings and, you know, the big cast and the diversity in the cast. There was no show that was that diverse.
Yeah.
I just loved it. I loved it. I felt like I was learning about people, and I'll never forget. I mean, there's some iconic moments that don't get enough credit. Like the moment in the fourth episode of season one, which is called Walkabout, which was John Locke's first flashback episode. John Locke was played by Terry O'Quinn, who won an Emmy for the role. You realize he's in a wheelchair outside of the show. And then in the flashback, it's revealed that he's in a wheelchair and that he's somehow able to walk on the island.
Right.
I was like, God, like as a hook, as just like something to get you to keep watching, like there's nothing better than that, especially at a time when there were no other shows like that. And to think what they would have been able to do had that show been on HBO later, or even like, you know, on Netflix later. Like that show was a true victim of being on a network and then not knowing how to execute a show like that at the time in that format. And also the writer's strike at the time, like it just made them unable to find footing narratively. And that show paid the price. It ultimately became a Wild West, lawless, ruleless, nothing matters. Characters are dead, but not really. It was just soup.
Yeah. And the creators had, and they had said, to your point about the network of it all, right? Like the creators, you know, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse and J.J. Abrams, although it was, you know, Lindelof and Cuse who like really, you know, shepherded it.
Yes, their baby.
They admitted like we didn't know where it was going.
And they were lying about that the whole time. And it became clear that they were, and it became really frustrating as a fan once it became clear that they were.
They lied, but also I think they were also telling the truth. I think both can be true. I think they knew, like, the big thing they lied about was, this isn't a religious allegory, just kidding. Yes, it is, just kidding.
Which really hurt. It really hurt for that to be true at the end of it.
In a different world, what a different show it could have been. You know, like, one of my favorite shows that's on my criteria is Friday Night Lights. And I look back and I'm like, thank God for the writer's strike in those last three seasons being 13 episodes, because I don't know if what they would have done with 22. And the fact that Lost had those full network seasons, I mean, you've seen what Lindelof has done in the wake of that with The Leftovers, with Watchmen, you know, and with a more distilled experience, things like that John Locke moment, you know, like that incredible lore reveal and like, there's some like magic mysticism going on. He can walk, but he couldn't before. But it's all rooted in character and who he is and how he's acting and why he is the way he is on this island compared to everybody else. Like that was so masterfully done that it just got watered down over so many episodes, where if that could be more crystallized, that feeling of those moments like that, then yeah, I think it's, you know, Lost is on way more criterias. It's in the conversation way more, and we probably have a better finale because of it.
Definitely.
Remade as a 10-part Netflix series, guys. Pitch it.
Let's leave Lost on a positive note. You mentioned that season one, episode six. Just top of your mind, when you do think back to Lost, what are those highlights? What are those moments that just, you know, hit that nostalgia, put you back in that place of wondering what was going to happen next and, you know, debating and the Redditing? Like, what were those moments that stand out for you when you remember watching Lost?
You know, I think the peak of my fandom probably came. I remember they did this weird thing where they, in season three, They did 6 episodes in the beginning of the fall, and then they were going to take a long break, and then there was going to be, like, they were going to resume the season in January. So they did almost, like, a 6-episode mini-season, which was Jack being, like, interrogated by the character Juliet, who's played by Elizabeth Mitchell, who was a great character on
the
show.
She was great, yeah.
And then Sawyer and Kate in the cages.
The cages, that's right. Yeah, okay.
That was the time I thought the most, what the fuck is going on? Because the others were like, we were with them.
Right.
And yeah. We had been waiting for that for such a long time. And to find out that these were the actual others, like, you know what I mean?
I saw Jack. They brought me in to see him. They want him to do surgery on Ben.
Who the hell's Ben?
Henry, the guy who brought us in. He's sick. And they say that if he does it, they're going to let us all go.
And you and me are what? Bait?
Something like that.
At least the doc ain't dumb enough to do it.
I told him he had to.
Why the hell would you do something so stupid?
To save your life.
My life don't need saving.
You want to die? Because that's what's going to happen. Pickett is just waiting for his chance. I've seen him look at you.
Damn it, Freckles, stay put.
And you know what he's going to do. So don't pretend like you don't care.
Get out, Freckles. We've already been through this.
Shut up, James.
And then once that season kept going and we got the Juliet flashback episodes, which were great, Elizabeth Mitchell's performance was great, and Michael Emerson as Ben, you know what I mean? Like, that was the point where I was like, okay, now we've actually got new characters here, because Michael Emerson as Ben had been in the second season, but then he was reintroduced as this whole other thing. And he also won an Emmy for the show. But I would say when that was ramping up and it felt like they could actually get off the island, that was like a really exciting time in the show. And of course, the first season, like I was saying, when a new flashback would be revealed and we just saw whatever new texture they were revealing about where these people had come from, because it was always really random, specific, weird, and interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, when the flashbacks were still feeling new and when it felt like the show was narratively reaching its conclusion,
yeah,
which was them getting the fuck off.
Right. Matt, what is your next favorite pick?
So again, like being a aspiring comedy writer when I was, 17, 18 years old, going to college, the bar for a television comedy was 30 Rock.
So good.
It very much, almost explicitly influenced my style of comedy. I love a joke in every line. I love live action cartoons. I like broad, big. I mean, I appreciated the gopher broke Muppetness of 30 Rock.
Muppetness, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pound for pound, it is still, I think, the funniest show that's ever been on television, just in terms of jokes, especially if you're someone that understands the entertainment industry and like the way that the corporate machine rubs up against it. Like, I think it was a very brave show of her to do in many ways, because mm-hmm. it was specifically being like, hey, I know I do this to make money for a corporation. Here's a show explicitly about how that fucking sucks. and I also think, you know, she was really like, it was genius because we knew her as Weekend Up at Tina Fey. Yeah. And mm-hmm. then she was able to like use that to create a world that was familiar but totally new. And I mean, 30 Rock, again, people say like, oh, you know, it got less funny. It never got less funny.
It never got less funny.
It never got less funny. It was so funny. It actually got in many ways better by the time it was over. And that I truly mourned that loss when it was over. I really did. Because it again was a blueprint for comedy that would follow.
30 Rock is one. It wasn't on my criteria, but I think it was an almost show for me.
Yeah.
I loved it. My roommate worked on it.
Really?
And yeah. And so I got to go like to some readings, like some table reads. I got to go to like some parties and stuff. It was like, that was like a real charmed life when she was working there, because we would get to go to SNL.
Oh yeah.
I was just like, I'm living the life. I'm doing this thing.
Especially when the two went hand in hand. So there was crossover mm-hmm. for her being on 30 Rock and it's like, you know, heyday. And then her doing Sarah Palin at the time. I mean, she was huge. Yeah. And so this was like, it was heaven for a comedy fan.
Yeah.
It really felt like, in many ways, like the world was orbiting her in this in a comedic sense. And yeah. Like the fandom for her was so crazy. She was like Tina Fey was like a Beatle there that year. You know what I mean?
God.
Like I remember like it was crazy to the and then to also it had have been a fan of Mean Girls years prior. Mm-hmm. Like I still think Mean Girls is the funniest movie ever. That and Clueless, like to give you an idea of what I like to watch. You know what I mean? But like but this was, I mean, 30 Rock, like every character, again, so funny playing their game. And also when they didn't work, they got the fuck rid of them. But what I love is it's like you had your five characters, your four or five characters that like really worked, which were Liz, Jack, Jenna, Tracy, and Kenneth.
And Kenneth.
And then like, you know, the rest of the world was populated by these like wackos.
Yeah.
Like, and I just loved it. Like, I mean, and also all the... People talk about Will and Grace being like the best guest star machine. No. 30 Rock wipes the floor with Will and Grace.
Oh, sure.
Like, Salma Hayek, Julianne Moore, Elizabeth Banks, like anyone that Jack Donaghy ever dated. Also, never forget the legend, Elaine Stritch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chris Parnell coming through.
Pee-wee Herman in my literal favorite episode when he's the prince.
Yes. Yes.
Welcome to
my
party.
Oh, my God. Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, I mean, just and Martin Short, like, I mean, just like it was beyond. And like, oh God, Oprah, remember the Oprah episode? I'm Pam. Like, sweater capes, calypso music, these are the things Oprah says are in. And then you find out it's this crazy girl Pam that she sat next to on a plane when she was high and she thought it was Oprah. I mean it was just so funny. Like, and
oh
I honestly
God,
like
right.
You could trace it back to like a love of like super broad sketch comedy and cartoons.
Yeah,
like really.
Yeah.
And I miss that. This was just funny. I mean, like, it's just, it's why I like Big Mouth now, actually. Because it's a joke driven cartoon. Yeah. It's like, I'm actually on it this season.
Oh my God, seriously?
I'm in the 7th episode. I'm in a Lola centric episode. So basically this was another great episode of 30 Rock when Tina Fey was like, it's Mamma Mia. So we do like a Mamma Mia episode of Big Mouth this year. And I play, I was in a boy band called Bros for Life. And one of the three of us claims to be her father. So there's like a Mamma Mia episode with Lola. And it's me, Ed Helms, and Adam Levine from Maroon 5.
Get out of town.
Yeah. And it's like a musical episode. I sing a song in it. It's really fun.
That's awesome.
But I love Big Mouth because it's just jokes. You know what I mean? And also it's like a fun atmosphere. Yeah, still love 30 Rock.
It was, so when I was a page, the amount of times I got, oh, like Kenneth, was just sheer, like, it was unbelievable. People in the street, like, hey, Kenneth, where's Top of the Rock? I'm like, my name's Dan, it's right there, but go over there. You know what I mean? Like,
also, if you thought it was a heightened reality, like, Kenneth never would have been hired as a page. Being hired as a page is really hard. It's really competitive.
Never.
Loving television is not enough.
Nope. Yeah, that moment of being a page while it was on, Tina was around. They did the 30 Rock Live while I was a page. So, like, I was around for that in 8H. Like, it was just all-encompassing, but in the best way. You're like, yeah. People are like, what do you do? What's your job? I'm like, have you seen 30 Rock? Just like, you know, give it a watch. Kinda.
A less insane version of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is, it's the funniest show ever. I still put it on sometimes, like when I just want to be happy.
What are some of your favorite moments?
Favorite moments of 30 Rock. Okay. First of all, here's a specific moment. This is my favorite type of joke. There's a scene with Jenna where she turns to a mirror and she just sings to herself, I see myself in you. And she's just singing to the mirror. And honestly, super cut of any of Jenna's lines, period. Like, I'm happy, I'm fine. When Jenna goes on Hardball in the first season and she has a whole scene with Tucker Carlson, which to show you what a different world it was, like, you know, for someone hot, you are really cranky, she says to Tucker Carlson. When he was, I guess, not a full, like, you know, maniac and, like, was still doing things like this. But, like, for me, Jenna as a character, iconic forever. Everything about it was absolutely genius to me.
This is Manhattan real estate. There are no rules, like check-in at an Italian sex party. I mean, do you know how long I've been waiting for the lady next door to finally join her husband in hell? Hello, Mrs. Gerstein.
Oh, my heart is getting stronger every day.
Oh, you ancient bitch. You've already got a foot in the door. Here's what you're gonna do. Do you remember that horrible roommate you had back in Chicago?
You mean you?
I know it's my turn to do the dishes, but I'm in character. And if you make me do the dishes, I will kill myself!
You drove a lot of guys out of that third bedroom.
Okay, so another very strong category, forever.
Mm-hmm.
We're now, I imagine, entering Housewives territory.
Yes, because it's incredibly easy to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when you really watch it, it's, here's what I, and the reason why I said The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills is because I love all Housewives, and I think that every franchise brings their own flavor, and it's also deeply about something different.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, with New Jersey, I think it's about, obviously, it's about family dynamics. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, and especially family dynamics in a very masculine culture. Because I think there's a reason why on The Real Housewives of New Jersey, the husbands are actually paid cast members and their characters. Mm. And they're not on any other franchise. But I think it's because the family dynamic and the family structure revolves around men so that the women often are in conflict about that. It's like about being a dutiful wife and family member in this patriarchal structure that I recognize as being from Long Island. So I very much identify that when I'm watching that. With Potomac, it's very interesting to watch, like, because it's this wealth in this, like, very much like Black area, but there's this, like, really, there's this undercurrent of colorism mm-hmm. that is very much at play, which is, like, very interesting to see which cast members want to discuss it and who doesn't, and how battle lines are drawn. And, you know, it's just very interesting, especially like an extremely affluent Black area, to see this like ugly layer underneath it. But also they are so much fun. You know, with Salt Lake City, it's very much about how religion has dominated these women's lives and like how, you know, the second they're granted any freedom, like excess is something that like it's knocking on their door. I mean, like they are one bad decision away from condemning themselves for life, not only in the eyes of God, but in like they're like powerless. Like it's like real hard crime happening on Salt Lake. Like
it truly
Salt Lake
is.
It's like a crime drama.
Yeah.
And then what I love about Beverly Hills is Beverly Hills is about the elite Hollywood women and the cracks in the china that are revealed that show real darkness underneath. So the first couple seasons of Beverly Hills, they start as one thing, which is like, look at these opulent women living these major Hollywood lavish lifestyles, and they all have these like histories as child actresses, etc. And then you realize just how dark their lives really are. Mm-hmm. And one of the husbands takes their own life in season 3, and it's revealed that he's been beating her within an inch of her life every second she's been on screen. And then you're like, wait a second, like pulling back, like this was supposed to be a fun show about like these women relating to each other on this like in this like elite zip code, but now it's become this like documentary about women trying to cover up truth.
Wow.
And I think that that is actually much more interesting than people give it credit for, because of the whole like, you know, table flipping, wine throwing persona of the Housewives. And not mm-hmm. to say that isn't an element of it, but I think that that show actually is like better and captures more than it gets credit for. And I also think, as someone who's interested in social dynamics, like I said, with Survivor and, you know, I'm a TV writer, we're all in television. Like, ultimately, we're all trying to explore the human condition in some way. What I really like about it is the idea of conflict and resolution as something that makes the world go round. I think it's very interesting to observe the way people deal with conflict. And that is the entire show. Mm-hmm. So I just really like watching this type of character deal with conflict in ways big and small. You know, we could be arguing about whether or not you're the reason why everyone knows I'm an alcoholic, or we could be lying about, like, you didn't compliment my renovation. You know what I mean? And, like, I love that mixture of the high-low. You know what I mean? I love that. Like, I think that's rich, and that's where real life is. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I recognize someone getting more upset about the renovation than something big. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's interesting. And a plethora of different types of characters. And now it's become this real industry, the Housewives of it all. He just had BravoCon and it was like a WWF arena. You know what I mean? Like, it's this crazy Comic-Con level thing.
I was there.
You were there.
I was there.
Oh my God. Who was your favorite person that you met?
I really didn't meet anyone because we just got like general admission tickets. If I go back, I will only go back as a VIP. only will go back as a VIP. And it's like, I didn't pull enough levers this time.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not waiting 4 hours to meet Robin Dixon.
Yeah. So it's like, did I get a picture of Kenya Moore from very far away? Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
But we just went for one day. It was wild. In a way, it was like, wow, like everyone here, we all like the same thing. And we probably all like it for the same reason.
It's yes.
Like, because these are problems that like, I'm probably never going to have.
Right. You
know, not problems I'm never going to have. These are problems that I'm never going to resolve in the ways that these women resolve
yes.
their problems. Right.
And it's fun and to I have like an opinion that. About their type of conflict. You know
yes.
what I mean? Because it's so removed from you that you're like, no, I actually think Erica Jane is lying about knowing whether her husband scammed people out of millions of dollars. It's like, huh? Yeah.
And just like having such a strong opinion. Like I was just watching Potomac and Ashley is getting ready to like ready her statement on her and Michael and her publicist / homegirl.
Yeah. Publicist / homegirl
is saying, it's just like, well, you know, like the trolls are still going to come. They're still going to come. And Ash is like, yeah, you know, everybody just has an opinion on what they think definitely happened. And I was like, what? I hadn't really thought about them as, I never think about them as real people.
No.
And her saying that, like, kind of like the veil fell for a second. And I was like, put it back up.
Yeah. Well, I've met a few housewives. We've had a few housewives on the podcast. We've had Dr. Wendy on the podcast from Potomac. We've had Garcelle from Beverly Hills. And I always like want to make sure if we have a housewife on the podcast that I feel like I can talk to them about more than just them being on Housewives, because I don't want it to be boring for my listeners. But the thing is, like, when you dig in there, there's a lot going on because you really do have to be a dynamic person to be cast on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then whether or not you work out on the show is one thing, but like I really do respect them putting it all out on the line like this, because it feels on face value like it's a desperate move. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you're going on Housewives. But then again, like, no one was talking about Garcelle Beauvais 4 years ago. Now she's kind of a household name.
No, they're superstars. Like at BravoCon, they were superstars.
Yeah.
There were tens of thousands of people like trying to see them. Like people were standing in those 4 hour lines.
Yeah, they are part of the culture. You know what I mean? Like everyone knows Teresa Giudice. Everyone mm-hmm. knows Bethany Frankel. You mm-hmm. know, like it's just these, like everyone knows NeNe Leakes. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like and those are also in the heyday, those are like OG names, but also like what's crazy about the fandom becoming so crazy and niche is that these women will have fans forever.
Mm-hmm.
Like it is like, and I'm one of them. Like I was kicking myself because I didn't go to BravoCon. They actually said to me they wanted me to potentially moderate a panel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, or they wanted me and Bowen to do it. And it wasn't going to work out for Bowen and I would have had to fly back. But then I was sitting there watching Karamo host the Salt Lake panel. And I'm like, girl, get me in there.
You would have been amazing.
Get me in there. Like, I want to get in there. I want to ask the questions. Like,
yeah.
It is so fascinating. And then they are real people. And then you see them start to have conflict, like, on the stage right in front of you at BravoCon. And you're like, oh, my God, it never turns off because you're real.
You can just see that world of the Housewives is always on. The reunions have become bigger spectacles than even some of the episodes themselves, right? Like, two, three, four-part reunions, which is... That's wild.
No, the reunion is what you wait for. I mean, the reunion is where it goes down. Like,
yeah.
And the highest rated episodes of Beverly Hills this season were the reunions.
Right.
We needed to get some stuff resolved in those.
Yeah.
But speaking of Beverly Hills, so why did Beverly Hills make your forever?
Yeah, out of all of them.
The reason why Beverly Hills makes my forever is because I think there's so much of it. And I also think that for me, it's the atmosphere I enjoy watching the most because
okay.
it still remains really opulent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something I like watching is like I'm not tired of the excess.
Mm-mm.
Like, I enjoy that element of it. Not to say that I don't like the other franchises because they go to Nashville and ride a bike. You know what I mean? But like, but I just enjoy like Aspen trip. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? I enjoy we're going to Italy. I enjoy, remember that one year they went to like Dubai?
Yeah.
Like, and watching them all show up in Dubai and their like garb. It was just so, I enjoy the excess of it. And also like, I don't know, just like for me, that's been the one that I rewatch the most because mm-hmm. I think there's the most there. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, we've seen a lot of, not a lot of the cast, but many of them stay on for many seasons. Like mm-hmm. ask me about Potomac in 6 years. I'll be like, it's the world's greatest television mm-hmm. show. If like, you know, they stay. But yeah, no, I mean, Housewives is, it's comforting for me. It actually soothes me. I actually hear them argue and I feel like my shoulders drop.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Also because I'm not a person that likes conflict in my own mm-hmm. life.
Same.
Watching someone else's genuine conflict like exercises something for me. And honestly, I'll be real. When I've gotten into conflict, I actually feel like I'm better at dealing with it because I've watched Housewives.
Right.
Because I love that these women just say what they think. Like, they have to because they're on camera. I don't have to always say what I think. But I do think sometimes it has helped me with people to turn to someone and be like, you just did this. It made me feel this way. And I want to talk about it. Yeah. And maybe this is lame and weird, but I don't know if I would be like that if I hadn't seen it modeled before me so many times and know it won't be the end of the world.
Right.
And also, like, it helps me sit with things less. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So there's something about it that has inspired me in a way. Wow. And like, I maybe not made me better at resolving conflict, but certainly made it so that I'm not just the only one sitting with it. It is your problem now, too. Yeah.
The Housewives has taught me how to make it also be your problem and also how to never actually apologize.
Right, right. Well, you know what's funny, too, is it's like, now I'm ready to snap at the TV and be like, that wasn't an apology. You know what I mean? Like, and it really is just like, it's sort of that simple. You know what I mean? Or just like watching someone not be able to get out of their own way in a certain mm-hmm. amount of time. It's just like, okay, so I can never be like that. You do watch them sometimes and you're like, okay, I identify as her and not her. You know right. what I mean? I feel like that happens a lot with the Housewives shows. Like, I think they're avatars in a way.
Yeah.
And that's another reason why people connect so.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, and you go back season after season and your allegiances have changed. You know, it's like last season I was like, Sutton, get out of my face. This season I'm like, Sutton, are you the best? I think you're the best.
Sutton is a whole, like, you know, carousel of emotions. It is up and down all around. It is.
It's like really when you look at Sutton, you're just looking at like a raw nerve.
Yeah. Well, I always joke with Bo and Yang that one day it's like they're going to say, with your host, Sutton Strack, and musical guest, Candace. And it's going to be my favorite episode of SNL of all time. We always joke about Housewives going on to host SNL.
Like, oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
It has never happened. It will never happen.
All right, so what stands up next to Real Housewives of Beverly Hills as the other show to watch on a loop forever?
I mean, sort of the scripted version of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, which is Big Little Lies. I mean, wow. I do believe that Big Little Lies season one gives you everything I have said so far in this podcast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is great performances from women. It is atmosphere. It is aspirational, like mm-hmm. locale. It's gorgeous. There's a mystery element. It's also extremely funny. And at the end, I think it said something really real about a real problem. And I think that it has some of the bravest performances I've ever seen on television. I mean, the scenes with Nicole Kidman and Alexander Skarsgård where they are having their domestic disputes that turn into sex. Just as an actor and performer, I don't think I've ever seen anything so difficult to perform. And they make it look really easy and natural. And also understanding how many times you have to do things like that to get them. The way that Jean-Marc Vallée, rest in peace, like directed that show, the sort of verite way he did it. Like, I love the way it's edited. Like I said, it is so funny. The characters are great. I mean, and I think that it ultimately said something really powerful about community and friendship, even against all odds when you're really in danger. And I think that it was compelling the entire time. And I just, you know what another thing is? Like, I'll just never forget where I was when I was watching that finale. Mm-hmm. Because it was such a slow burn. And also, I feel like everyone was starting to understand that it was good as it was going.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To the point where it became appointment television.
It did, yeah.
Which was so exciting and is the only reason why they got a second season. And while the second season, I believe, loses some of the magic of the first season because did not have as pointed of an observation, which maybe it should have just been a limited series, but also no, because I'm never going to want less of these women. And then you had Meryl Streep, and it's like, mm-hmm. yeah, sure, it's like pulpy camp, but like, it's still Meryl Streep. You know, whenever anyone is like, I don't want a third season of Big Little Lies, I'm like,
get out of here.
You don't speak for me. Yeah. Like, you don't speak for me. Like,
take me to that beautiful beach. I want to drive across that bridge.
Also, the music in that show, I am a huge Reese stan. And I think it's the most realized Reese Witherspoon performance.
Sure.
It's like Tracy Flick meets Elle Woods in a way that's like, also with the director of Wild, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like her powers are fully on display here because I love when Reese is just playing a bitch. Like, I love it because I think it exists in her and she lets let it fly. Like, her and Laura Dern together facing off, just like the hatred they have for each other. And then that it ultimately doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, I love that. And again, I'll also point out the high-low, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. there is this intense, dark stuff happening the whole time. And meanwhile, they're arguing about like the children's play.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So it's like everything that makes me tick all in one show. So that first season, those seven episodes, I could fly through. And there's real showcase moments for these actors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In a way that I love. And again, not a bad performance in the bunch.
Now, Matt, the one pushback we have here, though, is I don't think you could just choose the first season. I think if you're going to go with Big Little Lies, you got to go with both seasons.
Well, actually, it's my forever category. So you're not watching it forever, and I am. And technically, it did compete as a limited series at that first Emmys. So it's actually on paper a limited series, hon.
Okay, so now we're getting into an argument here that I can get behind. Okay, all right.
I don't know, on paper.
Because it was billed as a limited. Brandy, what do you think? I mean, listen, if this were season one, you wouldn't be able to get away with it. We've been much more soft in our rules these days.
Also, you know what? I'll watch season two. Right. Like, take away the caveat. Like I said, like, it might not be my favorite. I might not rewatch it as much. Like,
but I guess the real question, though, like, in all honesty, though, like, I am curious with so few episodes, you know, compared to something like Mad Men. I'm really intrigued that, you know, Mad Men goes in best, where Big Little Lies, where everything you were talking about, I think, speaks to the level of how well executed it was, how difficult it was to do all of those different things in all those different ways. And I'm not trying to sway you. I'm just really curious, like, what made you put one in one spot and one in the other?
So for me, it's content versus quality. Like, when you're talking about best, quality-wise, Mad Men is the best.
Yeah.
Content wise, what's happening in the show? Like, it's PTA moms in this environment, like arguing and someone's dead. Like, I want that. They all go to an Audrey Hepburn party at the end. Nicole Kidman is in it. Like, Laura Dern screaming, I said thank you! Like, the fact that Reese Witherspoon is like calling Laura Dern a cunt. And that's just not happening on Mad Men.
That's,
So it's quality versus content. You know what I mean? Like, and I do take the second season of Big Little Lies into consideration when I don't put it in best. You know what I mean? But it's in my forever.
All right. I love it.
I think it makes sense.
I think it's also a vibe with Beverly Hills. Like, you know, in the afterlife, those two are a good thematic pair.
Yeah, they're great companions because it's like either I can appreciate something that's like getting something right in a scripted format and it's the same shit I like, or I can watch the real thing.
And we also do have like a little bit of a twist for our forever that we like to ask people, which is with one of your forever shows, you can watch from beginning to end every single time like it's the first time.
Yeah, that's probably Big Little Lies for me.
Right.
Yeah. Because let's be real. There's some episodes of Beverly Hills I'm going to skip. I'm skipping the season with Carlton.
Carlton?
Carlton Gevia is not...
Oh,
what I'm watching in heaven. You know what I mean? Assuming I go there.
Right.
I'm not going to watch it in hell either. Yeah. Or maybe they only give me that season. You know what I mean? Exactly. It's like you get there and they're like, welcome to hell. Here's Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. It's only the Carlton season. You know what I mean?
Wait, was that the same season? Or was she on the OC? Was her name Jocelyn?
Jocelyn.
Yeah.
Just flops. Yeah. I mean, like nothing, giving nothing.
Nothing.
Like, everyone's in a bad mood all season, but, you know. So, in hell, yes. In heaven, no.
Awesome. So, to recap, Mad Men and Survivor are the best shows that Matt Rogers has ever seen. Lost and 30 Rock are his favorite shows of all time.
Oh, God.
And he would watch Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and Big Little Lies Season 1. Okay, and two, forever.
You know, there's like little caveats in there. It's hard to hear it put that bluntly, but then again, I am the one who typed it out that bluntly, so I deserve to hear it. And I feel good about that. I feel comfortable with that. I feel it's representative of me.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's a great, I think you've got a great criteria going here.
It's millennial as fuck, like I said.
It is.
But, you know, there it is.
It's
in
who
a
we
nutshell.
Are.
Yeah, it's true.
Let's embrace it's our true. Millennialism. I'm an elder millennial, and I'll never let go of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm smack right dab in the middle of millennial. I'm born in 90. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm literally like right in the middle of what it is. So I have no escape. I'm not cusp in any way.
Absolutely not.
I'm a firm millennial who's a Pisces, rising Pisces, Cancer moon. Like I am who I am. I'm a millennial and I'm a water sign.
And your list, gay. And your list reflects. Your list reflects.
Yeah, I'm also a Kinsey 6 gay. You know what I mean? Like... I am decisive. God must have spent very little time on me. He's like, nah, this is what he is.
No.
To re-quote the NSYNC song.
Matt, this was so much fun. Before we sign off, we have a super quick lightning round.
Okay.
This is a mini BFF. So just one best, one favorite, one forever. We did not tell you about this category before. And because it is the holiday season, as this episode airs... And Matt Rogers, Have You Heard of Christmas?
Have you heard of Christmas? It's when Moses did the lake. Have you heard of Christmas? That was the night that they made Saint Nick a saint.
It's out yes. now on Showtime. Go check it out. We want to know, what is your best, favorite, and forever Christmas or holiday content?
Okay. The best... Christmas or holiday content. It's the claymation, the Island of Misfit Toys. So that's Rudolph. Yeah, that claymation thing. Silver and gold, silver and gold. That song, a bop.
Yeah.
That is like, that's like classic shit. You know what I sure. mean? Like, that's what I love. And when he puts the chalk on his nose to fit in. Mm. Oh my God. So evocative, so cathartic. So timeless.
So timeless.
My favorite, I would say Jim Carrey's Grinch.
Wow.
It's a performance that I think is like, comedically unimpeachable.
Okay.
I think to fax me, press the star key. You know what I mean? Like, what will I wear? And also Christine Baranski as Martha May Huvier.
Oh, sure.
Very
sure.
inspiring for yeah. me. If you've seen my special, you know that. What else? Molly Shannon's in that. Again, mm-hmm. great cast. Where Are You Christmas? I mean, iconic
Such
music.
A good song. Mm-hmm.
Written by Mariah Carey, by the way. Little wow. known fact.
Oh.
Yes, sung by Faith Hill, but written by Mariah. And yeah, just like some really good Christmas content. Easy to watch. And I think it's a really amazing comedic performance by him. Forever, just to bring it back to Mariah, like whatever Mariah special she's got out at any given year, mm-hmm. we'll say Mariah content. Mariah
yeah.
content I could watch forever. And we will be watching it forever.
Yeah. Her Apple TV Plus specials, my daughter loves. She's like, I want you to put on Mariah who sings.
Mariah who sings. Oh my God, like, that's so cute.
And I've seen it so many times.
I want you to put on Mariah who sings. You know who I bet would love that? Mariah.
I need to TikTok it. Because my daughter also loves doing TikTok. She's like, Mommy, do you think that you can just like take a video of me on your phone and then just like show it to people on your phone who don't know us? Like
oh
a lot of people. I was like...
She's clearly not your daughter, Brandy. I wonder where she gets this from.
No, she asked me to videotape her doing yoga, and it's like she hasn't even really seen YouTube videos, but she literally was like, hi, guys. I'm Yuli. Gosh. We're doing yoga. I was like, oh my God, if this bitch just like and subscribe, I'm dead.
She's already on camera talent. She's already like enterprising. I love it. Mariah would be very proud. But yeah, I mean, Mariah is like very formative and huge for me. Again, a huge influence. If you've seen my special, you know. Mm-hmm. So my special is like, you know how Mariah Carey's the queen of Christmas? This is a documentation of me trying to become the prince of Christmas. The pop prince of Christmas like Mariah. So that's the narrative thread. And Mariah looms large in that. And so, yes, I mean, you have to give it up. I mean, there's Santa and there's Mariah. And those are the icons of Christmas.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Yeah.
Mariah who sings.
Mariah who sings. All right. With that... it's a wrap on this episode of TV BFFs. Thank you so much, Matt Rogers.
Thank you.
Where can we find you? What are you up to?
You can stream my special, Matt Rogers, Have You Heard of Christmas? It's to be out now. So you can stream that on Showtime. I'm also on tour all throughout December. I'm doing 14 cities. Like, if I'm coming to your city, please come see my show. I'm on Instagram at Matt Rogers, though. I'm on TikTok at Matt Rogers, though. And you can listen to my podcast, Las Culturistas with Bowen Yang, which is out. New episodes every Wednesday. We're on the Big Money Players Network, which is Will Ferrell's podcast network, and iHeartRadio. So, I mean, yeah, things are good. And you can also, if you have Showtime and you liked my special, you can watch the series I'm on called I Love That For You, which is a funny comedy.
It is.
It is very funny.
With Vanessa Bayer and Molly Shannon and Jennifer Lewis. And I'm so happy you guys like it, you being in the biz.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is.
I really like it.
Truly, truly funny. We mentioned it a couple times. We do like recent catch-ups and it definitely, it came up and it was part of the convo. So you guys are doing great stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I really enjoy doing the show and fingers crossed that the second season gets greenlit soon because they're having a really good time writing it.
All right, well, please rate, review, and subscribe, and check us out on Instagram at TVBFFpodcast, or you can email us at TVBFFpodcast@gmail.com.
That's right. Please reach out. We would love to hear from you guys. Send us your six. We want to know what are your top six shows of all time and where they fall on your own personal BFF criteria. So send us your picks, and we'll share our favorites on the pod. And until next time, goodbye, friends.
Bye, friends.
Bye, friends.
You've arrived here at a critical moment.